The smell of fried chicken cooking and the excitement of playing with the pet rabbit under the sink increased his pace. He was running through the living room when he saw someone he had never seen before. A man sat on the couch, leaning precariously to the side, his right elbow supporting his body, and his head nearly flat against his shoulder. The strong smell of whiskey wafted from his clothes and his pores. Wes and the man returned each other's quizzical looks. Mary entered the room and stopped in her tracks. She would have recognized that hangover lean anywhere. The man looked through his partially opened eyes and saw Mary. A wide smile appeared on his face. "Hey, Mary. Damn, you look good," he loudly announced. "Hey," she responded, her voice as emotionless as she could make it. Wes looked at his mother, hoping she would explain who this man was. He moved closer to his mother's hip. Not only did he feel safer there than in the middle of the room, but also because the smell coming off the man was beginning to bother him. The man on the couch looked up at Mary and asked, "Who's this?" Mary smirked and rolled her eyes. She could not believe his audacity. Wes didn't understand why, but he felt a tension in the room. Mary looked down at her son and uttered the words she had never said before and never thought she would have to say. "Wes, meet your father." Chapter 2. In Search of Home. 1984. The phone was up to its eighth ring. It was 9 in the morning, and Wes hadn't seen 9 in the morning since his summer break started. He climbed out of bed slowly, irritable, his eyes still half-masted when he picked up the phone in his family's narrow hallway.
"Hello? Where's Mom at?"
Tony asked.
"Probably work already. Try her there."
Their mom was usually out of the house by 8:30 and didn't come back until well into the evening. Wes, now 8 years old, was free from any adult supervision till then. His brother, 6 years older, was the closest thing Wes had to a caretaker during the daylight hours and was fiercely protective of his little brother who idolized him. But lately, even Tony hadn't been around much. Tony was spending most of his time in the Murphy Home Projects, where his father lived. The Murphy Homes were built in 1962 and named after George Murphy, a legend in Baltimore for his work as a groundbreaking educator, but just as often they went by a self-explanatory nickname, Murder Homes. The 17-story monoliths were among the most dangerous projects in all of Baltimore. The walls and floors were coated with filth and graffiti. Flickering fluorescent tubes, the ones that weren't completely broken, dimly lit the cinder block hallways. The constantly broken down elevators forced residents to climb claustrophobic, urine-scented stairways. And the drug game was everywhere, with a gun handle protruding from the top of every 10th teenager's waistline. People who lived in Murphy Homes felt like prisoners, kept in check by roving bands of gun-strapped kids and a nightmare army of drug fiends. This was where Tony chose to spend his days. The conversation between brothers quickly turned to school. Tony knew Wes had just finished elementary school and asked him what he was doing to get ready for the start of middle school at Chinquapin, pronounced Chickenpen, by all of its students. Chinquapin Middle was 95% black. Close to 70% of the kids were on the school lunch program. Wes mumbled the verbal equivalent of a shrug. Tony was enraged.
"Yo, you need to take this shit seriously, man. Acting stupid ain't cool."
Wes sighed into the phone. He had heard it before. He loved his brother, but he had learned to ignore his occasional do-as-I-say-not-as-I-do tirades. Tony, by contrast, was desperately trying to give his little brother information he thought he needed, the kind of information that Tony never got. Tony felt his brother's life could be saved, even if he felt his own had already, at age 14, passed the point of no return. To Wes, Tony was a certified gangster. Tony had started dealing drugs in those shadowy hallways of Murphy Homes before he was 10. By the time he was 14, Tony had built a fierce reputation in the neighborhood. Despite his skinny frame and baby face, his eyes were lifeless and hooded, without a hint of spark or optimism. Tony's dead-eyed ruthlessness inspired fear. He spent much of his time in West Baltimore, but had decided to try to open up a drug sales operation in East Baltimore as well. Baltimore is a territorial and tribal city. Once the boys in East Baltimore heard that a West Baltimore guy was attempting to take over their corners, tempers flared.
Tony ended up in a shootout with a few of the corner boys. 10 minutes later, it was Tony's corner. But no matter how tough he was, or how many corners he controlled, what Tony really wanted was to go back in time, to before he got himself so deep in the game, and do it all over. He wanted to be like Wes. There's a term in the hood for a face like Tony's, that cold, frozen stare. The ice grill. It's a great phrase. A look of blank hostility that masks two intense feelings. The fire evoked by grill, which is also slang for face, and the cold of the ice. But the tough facade is just a way to hide a deeper pain or depression that kids don't know how to deal with. A bottomless chasm of insecurity and self-doubt that gnaws at them. Young boys are more likely to believe in themselves if they know that there's someone, somewhere, who shares that belief. To carry the burden of belief alone is too much for most young shoulders. Tony had been overwhelmed by that load years ago. Now, he wanted to help Wes manage his. Like a soldier after years of combat, Tony hated the war and wanted Wes to do whatever he could to avoid it. He was willing to risk seeming like a hypocrite. When Tony finished his rant, Wes hung up the phone and went back to bed. As soon as he was comfortably under the covers, the phone rang again. "Yo, you coming out today?" A gruff voice barked out. "It's too early, man," Wes replied. "Wait, okay. Give me 10 minutes. Wes was talking to his new friend, Woody, one of the first people he'd met when Mary moved the family to this neighborhood a year earlier. It was her third move since Tony was born. The first was from Pennsylvania Avenue to Cherry Hill to get away from Wes's father. The move from Cherry Hill to Northwood was to get away from Cherry Hill. Wes spent his earliest years in the Cherry Hill Apartments, a planned construction built after World War II to provide housing to returning black veterans. A neighboring development, the Uplands Apartments, was the white counterpart, built at the same time under the city's separate but equal policies. The Uplands became home to a thriving middle class, while the over 1,700 units in Cherry Hill became a breeding ground for poverty, drugs, and despair. There was never a question that Cherry Hill wasn't built as a sustainable community for its families. Isolated and desolate, it had no main streets. Small, poorly constructed faux brick homes lined the streets like dormitories. There were 3 swing sets in the middle of the complex that sat vacant at all times because all of the children had been taught to stay clear of them. The rest of the courtyard remained busy with drug activity. If you're not from Cherry Hill, you don't go to Cherry Hill. Over half of the 8,000 residents live below the poverty line. Mary shuddered every time she left the house and was plotting her escape from Cherry Hill almost as soon as she got there. When she moved from public housing to a 3-bedroom home in a suburban area in the Northwood section of town, she was trying to create more distance between her and the city's imploding center. Compared with the chaos of Cherry Hill, Northwood was a paradise of neat houses with fastidiously maintained lawns. Black professionals constituted the bulk of the residents, many of them graduates of the universities that sat on its borders, Loyola College and Morgan State University. Mary felt safe and hopeful there. Wes searched around his room for his football jersey. He played defensive end for the Northwood Rams, one of the best rec football teams in the nation. Wes loved football, and his athletic frame made him a natural. Even if he was just going out to play in the streets with Woody and some other friends, he wore that jersey like a badge of honor. The crimson Northwood that blazed across the white jersey gave him a sense of pride, a sense of belonging. He found the jersey in the corner of his room, grass still stained the white mesh from his last game. As football became more important in Wes's life, his performance in school declined. His test scores were high enough to make it to the next grade, but not high enough to make a legitimate argument that he learned anything. He was skating by, and since this was his third elementary school, he was able to do so with fairly little notice. Wes didn't act up in class, which kept him under the radar. His teachers spent 90% of their time dealing with the 5% of kids who did. Wes's teachers gave his mother reports that said he was unmotivated, but Wes just claimed boredom. He always felt he was smarter than the other kids in class, and that the work just didn't hold his interest. Wes laced up his white Nikes, beelined to his mother's room, and started to look through her drawers and closets for change, his daily ritual after she left for work. His mother would notice missing bills, but he could steal coins with no worries. In the corner of her closet, there was a large green-tinted glass jar of loose change, shaped like a tea kettle. He permanently borrowed about $1, enough to grab a few quarter waters, the colored sugar water sold in small plastic bottles at the corner store. He ran out the front door to meet Woody, who was sitting on the curb lightly tossing a football in the air.
"It's about time, man,"
Woody yelled. Woody lived one street over on Cold Spring Lane. When Wes moved to Northwood, Woody immediately noticed his size and speed and tried to recruit him for the Rams. They'd since become friends. Woody came from a working-class, two-parent household. Woody's father was a former sergeant in the Army. During the peak of the Vietnam War, he volunteered for the Army in logistics as an alternative to being drafted and being sent to the front lines like many of his friends. Wes loved his war stories, savoring every detail. But most of all, Wes enjoyed the simple fact that Woody's father was there. Before he met Woody, Wes had never really seen a father around. Single-parent households were the norm in his world. At best, kids would have a setup like his brother Tony's, whereby they would get to see their fathers regularly and even stay with them a lot. But a family where the father lived with the mother, happily? This was new to Wes, and he liked it. Sometimes he'd ask Woody to hang out, and Woody would reply, "Can't, I'm with Pops today." And Wes would feel a surge of conflicting feelings. He was genuinely happy for Woody, but he was also deeply envious. Wes and Woody tossed the football back and forth, waiting for other kids to show up to play. The houses on the street were large by Baltimore standards, two stories with small front yards. Wes's home was among the few on the block without flowers or colorful decoration in the front. It was also one of the few rentals on a block full of homeowners. Wes and Woody were soon joined by their friend White Boy. White Boy's real name was Paul, but everyone called him White Boy because his father was Lebanese-American and his mother was white. In West Baltimore, white people were a rare sight, so White Boy took the brunt of constant teasing. Despite clowning him about it, they loved him. Wes would always say, "The only thing white about him is his skin. Everything else is black. He's a real black dude." White Boy would just shrug and say, "It's not my fault. I was born this way." These had been Wes's boys since he moved out to Northwood, and they would remain his boys for life. The boys approached another group of kids toward the dead end on Wes's block and asked them if they wanted to play. Particularly during the summertime, the streets were full of kids, and this group looked like a good match for a game of street football. Wes, always up for a challenge, relished the opportunity to beat up on a new group of neighborhood kids. Wes was playing defense, guarding one of the kids from the neighborhood, who was playing wide receiver. The boy ran his pattern with Wes closely guarding him, pushing him slightly to throw him off balance. Wes didn't believe in taking it easy. If he was going to play, he was going to play to win. That was his style. The boy told Wes to stop pushing him. Wes pushed the boy harder. Wes was bigger and stronger than the other boy, a fact poignantly reinforced every time their bodies collided. The boy finally had enough and, after a final play of the drive, stood toe-to-toe with Wes, bumping his chest against the bigger boy. His nose brushed up against Wes's chin. "Didn't I tell you to stop touching me?" the boy yelled in Wes's face. "Make me, bitch!" The boy pushed Wes in the chest, creating a short distance between the two, then cocked his right arm and punched Wes square in his face. Wes stepped back and threw his hands up, not just to protect himself from another blow, but to make sure his face wasn't damaged. Wes had never been punched before, not like that, and he never expected this little dude to swing on him. The boy stared at Wes, seemingly as shocked as he was. Woody stepped in front of Wes and urged him not to retaliate. The boy who punched Wes was still trying to maintain his strut, but seemed to realize that he might have made a mistake by punching the bigger guy. Wes was stunned. Then he tasted the unmistakable bitterness of blood on his tongue. He stuck his lip out slightly and felt the skin splitting open. Blood flowed, staining his white Northwood jersey. The sight and taste of his own blood set Wes off. He clenched his fist and forced his way past Woody. Everyone waited for the next punch to be thrown. Instead, Wes broke into a sprint, running right past the kid. His focus was elsewhere. He left the kid standing there, confused, hands still up, preparing for a fight. Wes was running home. The commotion caused a stir, and neighbors began to look out their windows to see what was going on.
Many of them were already frustrated with the boys playing football in the street. Lost in their game, the players would curse, run through flower gardens, and scatter their quarter water bottles across the sidewalk. It was not unusual for the owner of a beautifully decorated and well-kept yard to wake up in the morning and see an empty bag of Lay's potato chips or cheese doodles drifting through. Woody and White Boy looked up at the neighbor's windows and saw unhappy eyes staring back at them. Woody ran after Wes to see what was going on, while White Boy ran back to his house to avoid getting in trouble. Woody cut through the back door of Wes's house. As he entered, he looked into the kitchen to see Wes slamming the drawer closed. With his left hand, Wes held a wet paper towel to his lip, trying to stop the steady flow of blood. The lip had begun to swell, and his anger grew along with it. This was a pride issue for Wes. He had just allowed himself to be punched dead in the face, in front of his friends, by a smaller guy. He could have walked away. He could have fought back on the spot and settled it. But when Wes had looked into the other boy's eyes, he knew he had to send a message. Tony flashed through Wes's mind. Tony wanted the best for Wes, but he still felt that part of his mission as an older brother was to toughen him up for the battles Tony knew Wes would have to fight as he got older. Some days, Tony would have Wes and Woody meet him at the Murphy Homes, where he would assemble a group of Murphy Homes boys. The boys would circle up like they were getting ready to watch a gladiator fight. Tony would order Wes and Woody into the center of the ring. Then he would call out the names of a few of the Murphy Homes boys. At Tony's command, Wes, Woody, and the boys from the projects would start wrestling and punching one another, first tentatively, but then with increasing viciousness, until Tony jumped into the circle and grabbed the back of their collars, separating them like pit bulls in a dogfight. If he ever slackened, Tony would pull an exhausted Wes to the side, get within a few inches of his face and say, "Rule number one, if someone disrespects you, you send a message so fierce that they won't have the chance to do it again." It was Murphy Holmes' law, and Wes took it to heart. As Woody got closer, his attention was diverted from Wes's left hand to his right, where he held a long-bladed knife. Woody carefully approached Wes and said, "Don't do it, man. Dude is not worth this." But Wes moved towards the back door, which led to the alley that connected the homes on each block. The alleys were narrow, barely wide enough for a car to pass through. Woody sensed where Wes was headed and ran to block the back door. Woody held on to Wes's arms and tried to talk sense to him, but Wes's rage blocked out every word his friend said. Wes tried to wriggle free, to no avail. He knew he couldn't overpower Woody, so he told him he needed to change the paper towel, stanching his wound. The moist towel that Wes held to his lip was almost solid red and began to drip blood on the living room carpet. As he walked back to the kitchen, Wes kept an eye on Woody. Woody turned his head away to see if the boys outside had moved from the front yard to the back alley. To no surprise, they had. What did surprise Woody was that they weren't alone. One of the neighbors must have called the police because two police cruisers had pulled up, flashing their red and blue lights. They blocked off the alley. The boys who were running from the front of the house to the back alley stopped, following orders from the police car that pulled up behind them. Woody began to think it was a good thing that he and Wes had come inside. The slamming front door brought Woody's attention back to the kitchen. Wes was gone. Before Woody could tell Wes that the police were out back, Wes was on the other side of the front door, knife in hand, hurrying to settle the score with the boy who had busted his lip. Wes was now in a full sprint, clearing the five steps of his front porch in one leap, and then running around to the alley, figuring that's where the boys were. His pace slowed as he turned the corner. Right in front of him was a boy who'd split his lip. The anger he'd felt minutes before rushed back. He gritted his teeth and clenched his fists. His eyes started to stream with tears of anger, confusion, and fear. He began to scream. His vision tunneled till the only thing he saw was the boy who'd punched him. Nothing else was on Wes's mind or in his sights. Not even the policeman who had just stepped out of his cruiser. The policeman left his car just in time to see the other kids clearing out of the alley and sprinting away. Wes was still preparing to take the fight to the next level. He took a few quick steps towards the boy who punched him, holding the knife to his side. The police officer yelled at Wes, "Put the knife down!" Wes didn't hear him. Wes continued to move towards the boy. His grip on the knife handle tightened, his forearm flexed. "Send a message." After repeating the order one more time, and watching Wes ignore him again, one of the officers stepped forward. He lifted all 80 pounds of Wes off the ground, slamming him face first on the trunk of the police cruiser. Wes's chest collapsed against the trunk of the car, sending pain throughout his entire body. His hand loosened. The knife fell to the asphalt. The officer pinned Wes's body to the car with his forearm hard against the back of Wes's neck while he used his other hand to pull the handcuffs from the right side of his belt holster. Wes was incapacitated, the side of his head pressed against the cruiser, but he still had the boy who'd punched him in his sights. Wes wondered how it was that he was the one being arrested. He tried to plead his case to the police officer as he closed the second cuff on Wes's 8-year-old wrists. Woody went through the back door. He saw Wes lying on the back of the police car in handcuffs. "Why y'all got my man in handcuffs? What did he do?" Woody's screams were largely ignored by the two police officers. They were busy placing Wes in the back of one of the cruisers and told the other boys to go home. They ignored Woody until he shouted out, "If y'all don't let him go, I'm gonna have to kill somebody." Moments later, Woody was in handcuffs too. Woody was taken to his house in one of the police cars, while Wes was brought down to district booking. Wes sat there, pondering his next step. He didn't want his mother to know he'd been arrested. She'd probably ground him at least. It was summer, and that was the last thing he wanted. He used his one phone call to call his brother in Murphy Homes. Tony agreed to ask his father to pick Wes up. 3 hours later, Wes was released under the care of Tony's father, and he was back at his house before his mother got home from her job. It was years before Wes's mom found out her son had been arrested that day. By the time she did, she had bigger things to worry about. The extreme heat in my poorly ventilated room woke me in the middle of the night. I was dying of thirst. I crept slowly out of my room, careful not to wake Shani. Each stair let off an irritating squeak. As I reached the bottom of the alcove, I saw my mother half lying down, half sitting up on the couch, staring at me with wide eyes. It was obvious she had been sleeping just a few moments prior, but the sound of the stairs woke her. She asked what I needed, and after I explained that I just wanted some water, she insisted on getting it for me. I didn't need her help, but I didn't say anything as she rose from the couch to get a glass from the kitchen. Since my father's death, my mother had made the tattered brown leather couch in the living room her bed. Our neighborhood was getting more and more dangerous. There had been a rash of break-ins in the houses around us. My mother slept in the living room to stand guard, she said. She didn't want me and my sisters to be the first people a trespasser ran into if they entered the house. She was determined to protect us. The fact that sleeping in the living room also allowed her to avoid the haunted bedroom she'd once shared with my father was never mentioned. My mother still tortured herself with what-ifs concerning my father's death. Did she ask all the right questions? Should she have pushed the doctors harder for a clear diagnosis? Could her CPR have worked better had she learned how to do it properly when she had the chance? Her protective vigilance for her surviving family had overtaken rationality. For the past 2 years, she slept on the couch, listening, waiting, protecting. The death of my father had created a major stir in the journalistic community. He was young, talented, and admired. My mother, concerned about the effects on her children of a drawn-out legal affair, opted to settle out of court, despite believing she had a larger wrongful death case. Intent to make some sense of the tragedy, she used the money to create a fund that would provide equipment and training to paramedics on a new procedure for dealing with respiratory or cardiac arrest, a technique that could have saved my father's life. At the time of my father's death, none of the first responders were trained in the technique. My mother hoped her gift would prevent other families from having to go through what we had suffered. But her act of kindness could do nothing to ease our feelings of loss. She rubbed her knees and grimaced as they straightened out. She had started to gain weight, and what had once been a sprightly step had begun to slow. Perpetual bags hung under her eyes. I watched her as she walked by me, looking worn, almost defeated. After kissing me goodnight for the second time, she sent me up to my room and sat on the couch. With a glance back, I saw her rub her eyes again and rest her head in her hands. People around us didn't think she was coping well with her husband's death. They thought she needed help, not just in raising the kids, but in raising her spirits. Although we were surrounded by her longtime friends from college and my uncles and aunts from both sides of the family, it wasn't enough. She was losing her grip. She needed help only her parents could provide. A few mornings later, Mom woke up, made breakfast for us, and got Nikki and me off to school. Then she called her mother up in New York. Her mother had let her know that there would always be an open door for her in the Bronx if she needed it. But my mother had been determined to stick it out in the home she'd bought with her husband. Until now. "Mom, if it's still all right, I think we need to move up there. I can't do this alone anymore." My grandmother was thrilled. Before she even answered my mother, she called out to my grandfather, "Join the kids in moving up to New York." 3 weeks later, Nikki, Shani, and I all stood outside our car, staring with something like disbelief at our now empty home. This was it. We were actually leaving Maryland. "All right, guys, load up," my mother cheerily yelled as she threw in one final bag and slammed shut the trunk of our lime green Ford Maverick. Nikki helped me get my seatbelt done while my mother secured Shani in the car seat. Even as a kid, I could tell my mother's aggressive good cheer was for our benefit. Before we took off, she paused to take one final look at our house, the house she'd lived in for 6 years. It already felt like a past life. My grandparents weren't strangers to me. They'd spent quite a bit of time with us in Maryland. They were both recently retired, my grandfather from the ministry, and my grandmother from 26 years as an elementary school teacher in the Bronx. I was excited by the idea of living with them. They spoiled us like crazy. But I was apprehensive about moving away from my friends, from the only world I'd known. My mother prepared us for the move by telling us about her wonderful childhood and the glories of the Bronx. She told us about the neighbors who always had a hot meal for you and looked out for you if your parents weren't around. She told us about the amazements to be found at the Bronx Zoo, which was only 10 minutes away from our new home. She told us it was safe, that in all the time she'd lived there as a kid, she had not once experienced crime or violence. But when we broke off the interstate and started navigating the burnt-out landscape of the Bronx, we could feel her energy shifting. Things had clearly changed. The Bronx is an amazing place, home to over 1 million people. The diversity of the borough is extraordinary. Areas like the Italian immigrant-settled Country Club neighborhood were among the most affluent of the city, but were only minutes away from the poorest congressional district in the nation. When my grandparents moved to the United States in the 1950s, the South Bronx had already begun its transformation from a majority Jewish borough to one dominated by blacks and Latinos. When my mother grew up in the Bronx, despite rising poverty levels, the sense of family and community were strong. With every decade that had passed since she left the area, things had gotten worse. In 1977, when President Jimmy Carter visited the Bronx, he said it looked like a war zone. 7 years later, we were moving back. We'd stopped at a red light at the corner of Paulding and Allerton Avenues when we saw a woman walk up to a young boy standing on the corner. The woman was dressed in a blue shirt and faded blue shorts that showed off her scaly, ashy legs. She stumbled to the boy, with her right hand tightly gripping a wad of money. The boy, no older than 16, darted his head back and forth, apparently looking for cops, customers, or both. As she approached him and they started talking, the light turned green and my mother quickly hit the gas. Even craning my neck backward, I didn't see how that scene ended. We were now only 2 blocks away from our new home. When I turned back around, I could see the nervousness on my mother's face reflected in the rearview mirror. Moments later, we arrived. When my grandparents moved to the United States, their first priority was to save enough money to buy this house on Paulding Avenue. To them, a house meant much more than shelter. It was a stake in their new country. America allowed them to create a life they couldn't have dreamed of in their home countries of Jamaica and Cuba. Their plan had been to return overseas once they retired, but they couldn't bring themselves to leave. They sensed that they were needed here. Today was exactly the kind of day they'd been anticipating. The three-bedroom home always managed to somehow stretch itself when people were in need of a place to stay. The number of people who lived in the home at any given time fluctuated between 5 and 9, which made for tight living conditions. When we showed up that late summer day in 1984, we brought the number to 7. I walked up the stone stairs to see the front door open and my grandparents waiting there. My invitingly plump grandmother stood in the doorway, her hair in a light jerry curl, and a smile settled so firmly across her face it seemed permanently engraved. "Welcome home," she bellowed out to us in her Jamaican accent. She engulfed my entire body in her hug, folding me into her chest in a tight embrace. My grandfather stood directly behind her, waiting his turn to get at the grandchildren. My grandfather was a short man, no more than 5'6", but his presence dominated every room he entered. He was dark-skinned with a muscular frame that made him seem much younger than he was. People often compared him with his fellow man of the cloth, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, but of course that didn't mean anything to me. His mustache tickled as he hugged me and kissed me on the cheek. After unloading the car, my mother began to tell my grandparents about what she'd seen earlier, the woman buying the drugs from the young boy. She also told them about a telephone pole she noticed outside their house that had been converted into a makeshift memorial. There was a picture of a young girl taped to the pole, and sympathy cards and tiny stuffed animals were scattered around it. Signs saying, "We love you and see you in heaven," were taped around the little girl's picture. Her name was April. The shrine had unsettled my mother. My grandparents told my mother about the changes that had been taking place in the neighborhood. As I sat next to her, trying to spin a basketball on my index finger, I heard my grandparents talk about how drugs and violence had slowly crept in. Fear and apathy had become the new norm in what had once been a close-knit community. They also talked about something I had never heard of before. Crack. My grandmother left the table and went into the kitchen. She returned a few minutes later with a large pot of codfish and ackee, the official dish of Jamaica, and a large helping of grits. They had spent days preparing the dish in anticipation of our arrival, my grandfather serving as sous chef, deboning the light salty fish and chopping up the onions and peppers, while my grandmother seasoned and cooked it to perfection. Retirement had been wonderfully relaxing for them. That was all over now. My grandparents, Reverend Dr. James Thomas and Winnell Thomas, met when he was an 18-year-old ministerial student in a small Jamaican parish, and she and her parents were newly arrived parishioners from Cuba. My grandmother's parents left Havana in the 1930s in search of work. At the time, Jamaica was an island of relative prosperity amid the worldwide Great Depression. My great-grandparents loaded up on a boat in Havana Harbor with 6-year-old Winnell and prepared to create a new life in Jamaica. The two largest islands in the Caribbean were only 90 miles apart, and my great-grandparents planned to return quickly after a temporary stay in Jamaica to make some money. In fact, my grandmother's older sister, Lurleen, was left behind. But the family never went back to Cuba, and my grandmother never saw her sister again. When my maternal great-grandparents arrived in Jamaica, they searched for a church home. One Sunday, they entered Mount Horeb Church in St. James Parish and were immediately impressed by the young, dynamic pastor, Josiah Thomas. My grandmother, however, was even more struck by the pastor's son. Their friendship was quick and easy. As they got older, their love for each other developed. They were married in 1948. My grandfather had a dream to follow his father's footsteps and join the ministry. Since he could remember, he'd wanted to lead his own congregation. But to do it, he needed to complete school. His father used to tell him, "Being a leader in the faith is about more than simply proclaiming the word. You must be a student of the word." The first step along that road was to leave his new bride and his homeland to attend Lincoln University, a historically black college in Pennsylvania. When he arrived in the middle of November, he had his Jamaican wardrobe, shorts, short-sleeved shirts, and a few pairs of slacks for fancy occasions. On his first day on the picturesque campus, he walked briskly through the bracing Pennsylvania wind and fallen autumn leaves in open-toed sandals and shorts. "Hey you, come here quickly." The voice came from a man standing about 30 feet away. My grandfather hesitated. Not only did he not know the man, but also because it was too cold for small talk. The man jogged over to my grandfather, who speed-walked to meet him halfway.
"Where are you from?"
the man asked. He wore an elegant black suit and black tie, and his demeanor was irresistibly cheerful, which put my grandfather at ease. His accent wasn't American, but my grandfather couldn't quite place it.
"Jamaica," my grandfather proudly responded.
"I knew you were not from here. We need to get you some appropriate clothes.
Don't worry. When I first came here, I did the same thing."
The man took my grandfather to the store to buy him some warm clothes to wear until he could properly equip himself for the winter. The shopping excursion was the first of many encounters between my grandfather and this man, who would become a mentor, teacher, and friend to him. They spent many hours talking together about the changing world and the dawning of independence and liberation movements across the African diaspora. He tried to convince my grandfather to go into politics, as he hoped to, and change the world through that means. But my grandfather insisted that God was calling him to serve through the ministry. The two men's paths diverged over time. The man who mentored and clothed my grandfather followed his dreams and made history. That man, Kwame Nkrumah, became the president of Ghana, the first black African president of an independent African nation. After completing his education, my grandfather moved to the South Bronx and brought his wife and kids with him. In 1952, my grandfather, son of a Presbyterian minister and now a Presbyterian minister himself, became the first black minister in the history of the Dutch Reformed Church. The Dutch Reformed Church, born in the Netherlands during the Reformation, had spread throughout Europe and around the world, and even eventually became the official religion of apartheid South Africa. My grandfather's pioneering ascent to the ministry was met with many cheers, but some threats as well. He battled through them and made history. 32 years later, he hadn't changed. He sat across from my mother and told her that the changes in the neighborhood had not diminished his belief in the community. He was determined to stick it out and do his part to heal what was broken in the Bronx. I continued to spin the ball on my finger. The first few days after the move, I became antsy. I missed my old friends in my old neighborhood. I had thought my mother's rules were strict, but soon realized that my grandparents were many times worse. They made it very clear that Paulding Avenue was their home and their rules would apply. When the streetlights went on, we had to be back home. All chores had to be done before we even thought about going outside to play. If we heard any gunfire, or, as my grandmother called it, foolishness outside, we were to immediately return home, no matter when it was. These were not Bronx rules. These were West Indian rules. And my grandparents figured, if these rules had helped their children successfully navigate the world, they would work on their grandkids too. My restlessness was cured only by heading out into these new streets. After completing my chores one day, I got permission to play basketball at a park 5 blocks from our house. "Go play and come right back," were the orders I heard as I began to dribble my basketball up the concrete sidewalks toward the courts. I took my time getting to the courts, practicing dribbling the ball between my legs, but I also tried my best to absorb the new neighborhood. There were many more people in the streets, sitting on the stoops, hanging out, than I was used to. The boom bap of early hip-hop, still young and close to its Bronx roots, tumbled out of apartment buildings, mixed with Spanish music blaring from boomboxes. The Bronx was in its post-apocalyptic phase. Whole blocks were abandoned, buildings blackened and hollowed out by fires set by arsonists, many of whom were in the employ of landlords looking to cash out of the deteriorating ghetto. I didn't have much of a frame of reference back then, though. I didn't know that drug fiends were still making use of those abandoned buildings for activities that would have blown my mind, or that the swollen hands on the man leaning against the telephone pole by himself, eyes flickering, head nodding, were telltale signs of needle injections. I walked past neighbors whose eyes overflowed with desperation and depression, people who had watched their once proud neighborhood become synonymous with the collapse of the American inner city. With every step on those cracked sidewalks, I passed a new signifier of urban decay. But I didn't even realize it. I was a kid and just happy to get out of the house. The people I passed would look me up and down, and I would look back, give the traditional head nod, and then go back to practicing my crossover dribble.
I finally arrived at the courts and saw a handful of guys playing 3-on-3. They all looked a little older than me, or at least bigger than me. I quickly realized they were all better than me, too. The red iron rims had no nets, and since there was no real give on the rims, every shot ended up as either a silent swish or a high bouncing brick. Although I was intimidated, I called next because I knew my deadline for going back to the house was quickly approaching. I was practicing my lefty dribble next to the iron gate that surrounded the courts when one of the guys fell hard to the ground. He had been accidentally hit in the face while driving to the basket. Blood trickles from his mouth. He quickly walked off to get some water and clean his face. No foul was called. I would soon learn that calling fouls just wasn't done. The players realized they were short one man. The group looked at me, seemingly all at once, since I was now the only person on the sidelines. "You good to run?" one of the boys asked me. I dug up all the confidence I had, placed my basketball on the ground, and began to walk towards them. My oversized sneakers clopped in the court like a pair of Clydesdale hoofs. My new teammates called out their names as I gave each of them a quick dap, an informal greeting of clasped hands and bumped chests. "What's up, I'm Oz." "What's going on, Deshaun?" I played hard, lost pretty bad, but enjoyed every minute of it. These kids were different from my friends back in Maryland. I quickly started to pick up on their lingo and style, the swagger of my new teammates and neighborhood friends. From this first moment on the Bronx court, I could tell there was something special about it. The basketball court is a strange patch of neutral ground, a meeting place for every element of the neighborhood's cohort of young men. You'd find the high school phenoms running circles around the overweight has-beens, guys who'd effortlessly played above the rim years ago, now trying to catch their breath and salvage what was left of their once stylish games. You'd find the drug dealers there, mostly playing the sidelines, betting major money on pickup games and amateur tournaments, but occasionally stepping onto the court, smelling like a fresh haircut and with gear on that was too fine for sweating in. But even they couldn't resist getting a little run-in. And God help you if you played them too hard or stepped on their brand new Nike Air Force Ones. You'd find the scrubs talking smack a mile a minute and the church boys who didn't even bother changing out of their pointy shoes and button-up shirts. You'd find the freelance thugs pushing off for rebounds and the A students quietly showing off silky jump shots and then running back down court, eyes down, trying not to look too pleased with themselves. There'd be the dude sweating through his post office uniform when he should have been delivering mail, and the brother who'd just come back from doing a bit in jail. You could tell by his chiseled arms and intense stare, and the cautious smile he offered every time a passing car would honk, and the driver would yell out his name, welcoming him home. We were all enclosed by the same fence, bumping into one another, fighting, celebrating, showing one another our best and our worst, revealing ourselves, even our cruelty and crimes, as if that fence had created a circle of trust, a brotherhood. We played that first night until I saw the streetlights come on, my cue to head to the house. I asked them when they would be back out playing, and they said tomorrow, same time, same place. So would I. Chapter 3. Foreign Ground. 1987. Just stand next to the white people. They'll get off by 110th Street. Justin wrote down his strategy for securing a seat as we shoved ourselves onto the crowded number 2 train heading uptown. We had spent the day in Manhattan, taking a break from the Bronx, prowling the city's sneaker stores, checking for the new Nikes we couldn't afford. Now, on the subway back home, we stood in a crush of executives, construction workers, accountants, and maids, a multicolored totem of hands clinging to the metal pole in the middle of the car for dear life. 6 stops later, Justin's prediction proved out. A business-suited exodus emptied the train when we hit 110th Street, the last outpost of affluent Manhattan, and we were finally able to sit down. A subway car full of blacks and Latinos would continue the bumpy ride back up to Harlem and the Bronx. Justin smiled at me, just as the train's last yuppie scurried out ahead of the closing doors. Justin and I bonded from the first time I met him. We wore the same haircut, a towering box cut made popular by rappers like Big Daddy Kane, whose elegantly chiseled high top was the gold standard. Justin loomed over me, standing at almost 5'6" in fifth grade, and his skinny frame made him appear even taller. His voice was deep, an excursion into puberty that had left the rest of us behind. He lived in the Soundview Projects, just minutes away from our house in the Bronx. We knew each other's neighborhoods, each other's friends, each other's families. There was one other thing that helped us bond quickly. He was one of the few other black kids in my new school. My mother decided soon after our move to the Bronx that I was not going to public school. She wasn't a snob. She was scared. My mother was a graduate of the public school system in New York herself, and the daughter of a public school teacher in the same system. She knew the public schools in the area. The schools she had gone to were still there, same names, same buildings, but they were not the same institutions. The buildings themselves were dilapidated, crumbling walls and faded paint, and even if you were one of the lucky 50% who made it out in 4 years, it was not at all clear that you'd be prepared for college or a job. Just as the street corners of the Bronx had changed, so had the public schools. Things were falling apart, and the halls of school were no exception or refuge from the chaos outside. But no matter how much the world around us seemed ready to crumble, my mother was determined to see us through it. When we moved to New York, she worked multiple jobs, from a freelance writer for magazines and television to a furrier's assistant, whatever she could do to help cover her growing expenses. She had to provide for us, and she was helping out her parents, who were living off two small pensions and their small monthly Social Security check. My mother would wake us up in the morning for school, and before we had even finished getting dressed, she was off to work, leaving my grandparents to get us there. My grandparents would pick us up after school, prepare dinner for the family, and get us to bed. Late into the night, my mother would come in from her last job and walk straight to our bedroom, pull the covers tight around us, and give my sister and me our kiss goodnight. The smell of her perfume would wake me as soon as she walked in, then comfort me back to sleep. My mother first heard of Riverdale Country School when she was a girl growing up in the Bronx. It was the sort of school you might find in a storybook, a fantasy for a public school kid. It sat along the banks of the Hudson River, and the rolling hills and the lush quadrangles of its campus gave it the grand appearance of a university. The ivy-covered buildings were like a promise to its students of what awaited them. It was the school John F. Kennedy attended as a child. When my mom visited the school again as an adult, she was immediately convinced that this was where she wanted my sister and me to go. Riverdale was in the Bronx, but was its own little island of affluence, a fact local residents were quick to remind you of in hopes of keeping their property values from collapsing to the level of the rest of the borough. My mother saw Riverdale as a haven, a place where I could escape my neighborhood and open my horizons. But for me, it was where I got lost. Justin and I got off the subway, covered with graffiti tags and all city murals, at Gun Hill Road, and began a 10-minute walk home. Everything about the Bronx was different from downtown Manhattan, more intense and potent. Even the name of the street we walked down, Gun Hill Road, suggested blood sport. As soon as we hit the Bronx bricks, our senses were assaulted. We walked through a fog of food smells blowing in from around the world. Beef patties and curry goat from the Jamaican spot. Deep-fried dumplings and chicken wings from the Chinese takeout joint. Cuchifritos from the Puerto Rican lunch counter. Up and down the street were entrepreneurial immigrants in colorful clothes, embroidered guayaberas and flowing kente and spray-painted t-shirts, hustling everything from mixtapes to t-shirts to incense from crowded sidewalk tables. The air rang with English and Spanish in every imaginable accent, spoken by parents barking orders to their children, or young lovers playfully flirting with each other. By now, all of this felt like home. On the way to my house, we decided to stop by Ozzy's to see if our crew was around. Ozzy was our boy, tall and dark-skinned, with a closely cropped Caesar and a soft Caribbean accent like his father. His basketball skills transcended his years. He was only in fifth grade when high school started to recruit him. As expected, there they were, our little crew sprawled along the white stone steps of Ozzy's house. Before I could properly get into the flow of conversation, Paris turned to me. "How y'all like it up there at that white school?" Paris was a good-looking guy with a brilliant smile he rarely cared to share. He leaned back as he spoke. His question was a challenge. "It's cool. It's whatever," I quietly replied, looking down at the ground. It was a sore spot.
In the hood, your school affiliation was essential. Even if you weren't running with the coolest clique, you still got some percentage of your rep from your school. And the name Riverdale wasn't going to impress anyone. If anything, it made my crew kind of suspicious of me. So I quickly changed the subject. What's up with the Knicks this year? Lame, I know, but I was desperate. Most of my neighborhood friends were attending public schools in the area. A few were attending Catholic school. But Justin and I were the only two who actually went all the way across town to attend a predominantly white private school. It would take as long as an hour and a half some days, depending on traffic, stalled trains, weather, and other factors. But we would make it there. And on time. At least initially. Nah, for real. What's up with Riverdale? Paris asked, bringing the topic back. His voice rose in the last word, as he made his best attempt at a proper British accent. I had to admit that Riverdale sounded a little like something out of Archie comics. It was embarrassing. I decided to try a different tact. Yeah, it's cool. Man, no one messes with me over there. I had that place on lock. I started, unconvincingly. My feet shuffled and my voice lowered a few octaves. I caught Justin out of the side of my eye, shaking his head with amazement at the nonsense that was coming out of my mouth. I could feel the burn of his skeptical stare on the side of my face. But I pressed on. Let me tell you how I run things up there, I said, and launched into the story of my recent suspension from school. A few weeks earlier, I had been suspended for fighting. I was playfully wrestling with a kid from my grade when I decided to go for a killer move. I grabbed his right arm with mine and hoisted him over my shoulder, then dropped him hard on the ground. The fall was awkward, and he landed on his head, opening a small but surprisingly bloody cut. After the boy was rushed to the school nurse and eventually to the hospital to get a few stitches, I was suspended for fighting. That was the truth. For my friends, I decided to juice the story up a little. Or a lot. The story I told had the boy disrespecting me and me getting in his face to respond. When he kept jawing, I picked him up over my head and slammed him to the ground. Then I stood over his bleeding body, taunting him like Muhammad Ali over Sonny Liston, daring him to get back up. My friends looked over at Justin, who had a pained expression on his face. He knew the truth, and soon, the rest of my friends did too. I became the butt of pretty unrelenting taunting. My attempt at creating a Westmore legend had backfired. I was saved after about 20 minutes when a man stumbled towards us. His hair looked like it hadn't seen a comb in weeks. There were laces in only one of his filthy sneakers. Can you young brothers spare some change? I need to make a phone call. He stuttered. An old and unpleasant odor preceded him. Ozzy responded first, his Jamaican accent a little thicker than usual. Get the hell out of here, man. Nobody has any change for you. The man slowly moved away, peeking backward a couple times, hoping one of us would overrule Ozzy's rejection. Ozzy shook his head in disbelief. If dude wanted to buy some rock, he should have just said it. Who the hell was he gonna call if we gave him some change? We all laughed as the panhandler staggered back up the block to look for sympathy elsewhere. Drugs were not new to the Bronx. Marijuana, cocaine, and heroin all took their turns as the drug of choice. But crack was different. After it officially introduced itself in the early 1980s, it didn't take long for crack to place a stranglehold on many communities. The Bronx was one of them. I was an eyewitness. Crack was different from the drugs that preceded it. It was crazily accessible and insanely potent. And addictive. My friends and I would regularly trade the most remarkable stories we'd overheard or witnessed. A father who left his family and robbed his parents for money to buy rock. A pregnant mother who sold her body to get another hit. Someone's grandmother, who blew her monthly Social Security check on crack. The other difference between crack and other drugs was its method of distribution. There was so much money to be made that drug gangs rapidly expanded their ranks, sucking in some of our best friends, and turf wars became deadly, aided by the influx of sophisticated firearms. The mayhem spread from the gangs to the rest of the neighborhood. Everyone felt threatened. Everyone was defensive. From the early 1980s to the end of the decade, there was an almost 61% jump in the murder rate. When I look back now, it's almost surreal. In 2008,
there were 417 homicides in New York City. In 1990, there were 2,605. Those murders were concentrated in a handful of neighborhoods, and the victims were concentrated in a single demographic, young black men. In some neighborhoods, the young men would have been safer living in war zones. We laughed at the panhandler on the block, but he wasn't just an object of ridicule. He was an unsettling omen. After sitting with the crew for a few hours, Justin and I decided to get back to the subway station so he could head home. The sun was beginning to set, so we knew we didn't have much time. We didn't need to check our watches. We were starting to feel the fear that crept around the edges of our consciousness at dusk. Justin lived a few train stops away from me, and taking the train home after dark was a different journey than the one we'd made earlier in the day. Justin knew the rules. Never look people in the eye. Don't smile. It makes you look weak. If someone yells for you, particularly after dark, just keep walking. Always keep your money in your front pocket, never in your back pocket. Know where the drug dealers and smokers are at all times. Know where the cops are at all times. And if night fell too soon, and Justin was forced to go home by foot over the Bruckner Expressway overpass in the dark, he knew to run all the way. We increased our pace. Neither of our mothers would condone us coming home late. His mother and mine were kindred spirits. Both were born in 1950. Both nicknamed their oldest children Nicky after Nicky Giovanni. Both knew all about the public schools in the Bronx. My mother went to school in them, and Justin's mother taught in them. And both were single mothers working multiple jobs to send their kids to a school outside their neighborhoods. Justin's mother looked after me like I was one of her own, the same way my mother did for Justin. The sun continued its rapid descent. We tried to keep a bop in our step, tried to keep it cool, but by now we were pretty explicitly speed walking. Breathing a little heavily, we did our best to keep up appearances. We laughed about our day, talked about school. Riverdale. The pristine campus and well-dressed kids had stunned me on my first visit. The Bronx was not the homogeneous ghetto I thought it was. I felt a crazy-making cross-current of emotions whenever I stepped onto campus. Every time I looked around at the buildings and the trees and the view of the river, I was reminded of the sacrifices my mother was making to keep me there. And every time I looked at my fellow students, I was reminded of how little I fit in. I tried to hide the fact that my family was so much poorer than everyone else's at school. Every week I sat down to create a schedule for my clothes. I had three good shirts and three good pairs of pants. I would rotate their order, mixing and matching so that each day I had on a fresh combination. Later, I even borrowed Nikki's clothes to show some further variation, thinking that nobody would notice the zippers at the bottoms of the jeans or the way the hips hugged a little tight. I would just nonchalantly say that I was trying to bring the 70s back. This claim was usually met with polite smiles when I was in the room, but I can only imagine the hysterical laughter and conversations about my cross-dressing when I wasn't around. When the kids would talk about the new video game system that was out, or how their family was going to Greece or Spain or France during summer vacation, I would sit silent, hoping they wouldn't ask me where my family planned on summering. At times, I would try to join in, chiming in about the vacation home my family had in Brooklyn, not realizing how ridiculous I sounded. The vacation home I was speaking about was the parsonage my grandparents had moved into when my grandfather came out of retirement to lead a congregation. Not until I got older did I learn that Flatbush Avenue inspired a lower level of awe than the French Riviera. Whenever I hung out with Riverdale kids, I made sure we went to their homes, not mine. I didn't want to have to explain. But in the sixth grade, I broke my own rule. My Uncle Howard was my mother's younger brother. He had recently made a decision with his medical school that becoming a doctor was not in the cards for him, and he moved to the Bronx, where he worked as a pharmaceutical salesman. He came up with the idea to invite some kids from the neighborhood to play a game of baseball with the kids from my school in a park near our house. I think he sensed my frustration at living in mutually exclusive worlds and thought a game of baseball would bring together my neighborhood friends and my wealthier Riverdale classmates and broaden the horizons of both. His intentions were good. I jumped at the idea. I invited 10 friends from school to come and play against my friends from the neighborhood. In the first inning, my neighborhood friend, Deshaun, who was playing first base, started trash-talking Randy,
a lanky Riverdale kid with a mop haircut, after Randy hit a single. Innocent stuff, until the